tax system is inequitable, with terrible loopholes for the rich and the super rich. In fact, my information is that the Laffer curve was drafted on the back of a napkin at a 3-martini lunch, or was it a 4-martini lunch? What does Kemp Roth do to reform the tax structure?
It is not a tax reform bill. It's simply a slash in all rates.
All right, we'll go to Mr. Rusher now. Your chance to cross-examine Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Stein, Mr. Dunn, since you're such a great respecter of Mr. Stein, why don't you agree with him in supporting the Kemp Roth bill?
Well, because I think that is an unfair way to go about it. What he argues is that first you cut the taxes and you use that as a way to slash away at expenditures. That puts the cart before the horse. The Laffer-Kemp argument is that you really don't even need a horse, the cart will go by itself.
Too bad that Mr. Schlossberg did not find it possible to mention that Mr. Stein was for the bill.
All right.
And the process of voting for it.
It does seem to me that those who argue for a large tax cut have an obligation to provide both halves of the package. Really, it's a two-sided package. You've got tax cuts, you've got expenditure cuts. What's happening is you're holding one hand behind your back and saying, here's the nice half of it, here's the tax cuts. Show us the other half.
Let me ask you...
Put together a balanced program
and
expenditure cuts.
Maybe some of it will support it. Let me ask you, maybe and maybe not, Mr. Dunn. Let me ask you something about the level of taxation. I understand even you to admit that some level of taxation would be counterproductive.
Certainly.
All right. Now, would you give us your best estimate as to what that level might be?
I don't want to get involved in guessing,
but
suffice to say that there are a number of countries that have tax rates higher than ours, some of which even have as high per capita GNPs as we do.
Uh-huh.
I would like a tax cut, but I think that's a rather strange argument to put up
for. In any case, you're arguing that the old goose still has a few golden eggs left.
I think there are a few. Uh-huh. I would also note that there are specific taxes that could be cut that might help. I would note that Representative Ullman of Oregon, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, today suggested the integration of the personal and corporate income tax. Personally, that strikes me as eminently sensible. You are using a hammer, a sledgehammer, where a tax hammer is called for.
Of course, Mr. Kennedy,
specific tax.
Mr. Kennedy used precisely what you call that sledgehammer, and I quote what Walter Heller, before he learned this was to be a political issue, said about the Kennedy tax cut. It did seem to have a tremendously stimulative effect, a multiplier effect on the economy. It was the major factor that led to our running a $3 billion surplus by the middle of 1965 before escalation in Vietnam struck.
I would merely note that the economy was in a very different state then with regard to the federal deficit,
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned one of the distinctions being that the unemployed today are less skilled. I happen to have been in Youngstown, Ohio, talking to some labor union people in February. Are you suggesting that the people who laid off at Youngstown Sheet and Tube are not skilled?
No, I am not. There are regions and areas of this economy
where
a particular industry has been hit where there are problems. You deal with problems like that with tax policies or economic policies that are aimed narrowly at those regions and those problems.
Why? Why can't you deal with it in a way that will make the economy as a whole healthy?
Because you'll overinflate those parts of the economy which are not greatly unemployed
let's
now.
Let's find out about
you're
that.
You're using a shotgun where something much narrower is called.
Well, let's see. You mentioned some foreign countries. Let's take two. The United States today has a maximum tax rate in the neighborhood of 70%, marginal tax rate. What about Germany? How high is the marginal maximum tax rate there?
I am not an expert on the German economy.
70% to save you the trouble. And how would you say the German economy compared today with the American?
It does rather nicely, in part because the government does not run large deficits.
Now let's take
the money supply growth is held down, so they don't have much inflation.
And one of the reasons they don't have large deficits is that they have the revenue that that kind of a tax rate produces. What about Britain? How high is the highest possible tax rate in Britain?
Pretty easy to get to 85%.
Well, you can actually get to 98%.
I would not argue for the British tax system, neither would the British at this point.
Would you like to argue for the health of the... I dare say they wouldn't. Maybe they would like a Kemp Roth bill if there were time for it and possible to crawl back to it. Do you think the British economy is healthier because of that high tax rate?
The argument for an across-the-board, very large tax cut, I think might be somewhat stronger in Great Britain than it is here.
So.
But note, they start out with a very different tax system and a very different state of their economy
to begin. All right. And if you wait long enough, the argument will be still better here.
Mr. Schlossberg, another question for Mr. Dunn, please.
Germany, for your information, Mr. Russians, Germany taxes 35.22% of the gross national product, about 17% more than America. If sound economics Professor, is not behind the Kemp Rothschild. What is behind it?
I think, one, just blind frustration with high expenditures, high taxes, the whole business with politics, what have you. More importantly, I think there's a hidden agenda. The notion that first we'll get the tax cut, the nice side of the package, and later we'll show them the other hand. Then we'll hack away at expenditures. I think they have an obligation to show us both halves of the program at the beginning. Tell us where you're going to cut the expenditures as you go along. Don't show us just the nice half and hide the other half.
All right, Mr. Rusher, one final question for Mr. Dunn, please.
Were you pleased and relieved when Mr. Schlossberg managed to change the subject of the German economy from the income tax maximum to the aggregate tax maximum? That's quite a difference, isn't it? And it makes the difference. Actually, the German maximum tax, income tax, is in fact substantially lower than that in the United States. Is that not?
It is true, but they also have very high sales taxes, which provides some
disincentive. Sure, but they have other taxes. We're talking here about income tax.
Thank you. Mr. Dunn, thank you very much for joining us on the episode. Mr. Schlossberg, your next witness.
I now call Congressman Richard Bolling, who is the author. Congressman Bolling is the author of the Budget Act and the chairman of the Joint Economic Committee. Congressman Bolling.
Welcome to the Advocate, Congressman Bolling.
Congressman, there's a lot of frustration about taxes in this country. People in this room feel it. I feel it. You feel it. Are you against tax cuts for Americans?
Of course not. As chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, I testify regularly before the Budget Committee and other places for sensible tax cuts.
But a massive tax cut, like Kemp Roth, this giveaway program, is politically popular. Why aren't you jumping on that jolly bandwagon?
I learned a long time ago not to rely on snake oil, fraud, or just plain stupidity. This is a very, very bad proposition.
Tell us, please, Congressman Bolling, who would be hurt by Kemp Roth? We've been told how great it is, how it will put the unskilled to work building quality products. Tell us, who would be hurt by Kemp Roth?
In my judgment, and I worked with Jack Kennedy on that tax cut long before it came to Congress, in my judgment, this is exactly the wrong thing. It might very well lead to disaster in this country, first through inflation alone, perhaps then through depression. It's precisely the wrong way to do it.
So you're saying everybody would be hurt by this?
Everybody will be hurt,
who will it fall the heaviest on?
It will fall the heaviest on the weakest people in the country. The old, the young who are untrained, minorities, all the weak in the economy will be the worst.
Well, let me ask you a kind of philosophical question, if I may. The choice seems painfully clear. Can this country withstand a trade-off between narrow self-interest and social responsibility?
Absolutely not, and that's the key to this issue. I don't think it happens to be with Jack Kemp. I think he believes in his proposition. But many of the people that support it know exactly what they're doing. They are special interests representing the strongest special interest in the country, the very rich.
Now, your colleague John Rhodes, the Republican House Minority Leader in the Congress, has called Kemp Roth, great compliment, Congressman Kemp, the Republican Party's answer to the nation's ill.
It's not that.
What do you think?
It's not that. It's the Republican Party's answer to the Republican ill. They're down to snake oil to try to win an election.
The backers of Kemp Roth give us a choice between what they call big government, and the limitless virtues of business. Can we rely on business, big and small, to preserve the rights and the needs of the people of this country?
The last time we did, we had the Great Depression, and that was a very long time ago. But business today is taking the most remarkably recalcitrant position I've ever seen. Right after World War II, there was cooperation between business and labor for good programs. Today, business is fighting more than ever for its own selfish interests.
Isn't it true today with all of our huge government expenditures, that about $100 billion a year of tax expenditures goes to big business and to business?
Well, there's no question that vast sums do. I think $100 billion would be a pretty good estimate.
And do you think, you know, we always hear, and especially from Mr. Rusher, who's very expert on this, about how bureaucrats rip us off, politicians rip us off. Did you know that the late Senator Phil Hart said that the American people are ripped off about $25 to $30 billion a year on car repairs? And would you comment on whether we can rely on the self-interest motives of the profit makers to protect us on these basic
issues? Never worked in our history nearly as well as it does when the people of the country insist on having a government that represents them all. The social interest of the country is far more important than that of any particular special interest.
All right, Mr. Rusher, some questions for Congressman Goldman.
Snake oil fraud, that's what you think it's about, huh?
Yes, sir, Mr. Cheap Shot Argus, that's why I boiled up. You fired three cheap shots at the beginning of every one of your statements.
And you think that the people of California were all taken in by the snake oil and the fraud, eh?
No, sir, I don't think that there's anything like the same thing. I don't even think that was a fraud. I think it's the kind of thing that I might have supported if I'd lived in that state. And the state had an enormous surplus. This is an entirely different situation.
Let's find out, Congressman. Do you believe that compassion has to be as costly in government terms as it is today?
No, sir. I don't think it has to be as costly. And the reason that I don't think it has to be costly is that we have a very confused system forced on the people in government by those who want to be sure that the costs don't come out of progressive taxation. The whole purpose of this exercise is to see to it that the bills that have to be paid to provide decency for people in this country don't come out of progressive taxation.
And yet,
the supporters of Kemp Roth want it to come out of the most progressive system that we have. They want it to go back. They don't want it to come out of that system. They want it to go back to the state systems, which are almost totally regressive.
Bear with me, Congressman. Last month alone, you know, this is an issue of spending and cost as well as of taxation, which is just the other side of that. Last month alone, you voted against a 2% across-the-board reduction in the non-mandatory items of labor and health, education, and welfare, didn't you?
I certainly am proud of it, too. And let me explain to you why, since you raised it. It's almost that kind of across-the-board cut, which is a classic technique, is almost as mindless, in my judgment, in terms of its effect, as is Kemp Roth. There's a good analogy there. It does not accept the responsibility of saying when it cuts income where you're going to cut expenditure.
Right. And you wouldn't vote either, did you, for a 2% reduction in the housing and urban development and independent agencies?
Absolutely not.
And you were against a 2% cut in the interior and the energy department.
No, I'll stipulate I've been voting against
and you were
cuts
against
for many, many years.
A 2% cut in the agriculture department.
I've been doing it for a long time.
You've been voting for big government for years.
No, sir, I haven't been voting for big government. I have been voting for services for the people of this country and a responsible effort abroad and at home.
Well, let's take the services of the largest department of them all, health, education, and welfare, which comes in this next fiscal year for $189 billion. Now, in the last fiscal year, Congressman, they themselves found $7 billion in fraud in their own agency, which is double the amount that you wouldn't vote to cut.
That has nothing to do with it.
It has everything to do with it.
It has nothing. I can shout as loud as you can without cheap shots.
You can be wrong.
No, okay. I can be right, too.
Let's have the congressman
calling about cheap shots. Wait,
hang on. You start.
Let's have the congressman answer the question.
The answer is very simple. I would vote for a cut for any fraud identified.
Yes, sure.
I would not think of voting for it. I would not think of voting blind on any cuts because the administration might make a serious mistake without guidance from Congress.
You wouldn't and didn't vote for a $4 billion cut in a $185 billion agency at a time when they were finding $7 billion worth of fraud in their own agency.
If I'd had a chance to vote on the fraud, I'd been happy.
I'll bet you would have changed your mind if you'd known about it at the time. Yes. You
complain about that. I didn't say that.
Oh, didn't you?
No, sir, I sure
did. Oh, yeah, that's right. You want the fraud to be established first, and if they will go in and establish it, then you will agree to cut the budget.
We don't try people and convict them all at the same time.
No, but we can
even
cut the
corporations. Even those corporations that make up so much of the business community are not convicted when they are found guilty of fraud and bribery and so on, as 58% of the corporations involved in the biggest business lobby organization in the United States have been.
You speak of the social costs.
We'll need a very
What about the social costs of the current tax rates? Is there any? The cost of trying to give your children a decent education, the cost of trying to improve the quality of your life, the cost of being unemployed in the stagnant economy that you and your party and your economics have produced?
Well, I'm so sorry that you said that last thing. This was all produced by, I guess, your party, if you're a member of the party.
When did it
all produce?
We're going to have to.
The recession and the very deep recession began in Nixon.
Yeah, but what?
Well, we're going to go to Mr. Schlossberg now. Mr. Schlossberg, one question.
Very little to do with what we're talking about. Congressman Bowling, as the author of the most responsible piece of legislation in years, the Congressional Budget Bill, would you please tell us? Can government be both competent and compassionate?
Of course it can, and it would do better if we got a single or even a dozen Republican votes on the resolutions dealing with the budget problem.
Mr. Rex,
Republicans have boycotted action on the Budget Act.
Mr. Rusher, one final question for Congressman Bowling.
You and Mr. Schlossberg have wept tonight over the unskilled youth for whom you have so much compassion. Why did you vote against a minimum wage differential for those youth so they could get jobs?
Because I think it's asinine, and I know the reason for it. The design is to see to it that those youths take the places of adults who support families.
So let them
That's the
you.
Purpose.
That's it.
Thank you.
Talk.
Thank you, Representative Bowling, very much for joining us on the advocacy. Closing argument, Mr. Rusher.
Did you notice that not even the other side tonight has dared to argue that taxes are not too high? But when we propose constructively and concretely to reduce tax rates, then they say, no, not this bill, not this much, and so on. Well, somebody somewhere must be in favor of these high taxes, else why are you paid? Did you hear all those predictions from the other side of huge deficits that tax revenues go down? That's because these people have no serious intention of cutting one thin dime from the federal budget. They say these huge expenditures are necessary to provide essential social services for the poor. Does that accord with what you personally know about the welfare system in this country? Health, education, and welfare found $7 billion of fraud alone in its $175 billion budget. Someone said that had the consummate gall to say the Kemp-Roth bill was a proposal to give the taxpayers a free lunch with Walter Heller. It is no such thing. It is a proposal to let them keep enough of their own money to pay for their own lunch. Taxpayers, let's hear your voices tonight from Maine to California. Vote yes.
Mr. Schlossberg.
We are all in favor of a tax cut, but the economics of Kemp-Roth are deeply flawed and its politics are cynical. In the end, the issue is very simple. Shall we have a wise tax cut and try to control the cruelest tax cut of all, inflation? Or shall we put tax policy on a radical path to the unknown? John F. Kennedy, President of the United States, said, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And Richard Nixon perverted that. He said, do what you can for yourself. Kemp-Roth is an exercise in such narrow self-interest. I say to you,
Enlightened self-interest requires a faith in responsible, compassionate government. Kemp Roth threatens America's future. It distorts American values. Let us turn away from its dangerous vision. Reject this snake oil and vote against it.
Thank you. Thank you. Tonight you've heard two sides of an issue concerning all of us. Should the federal government reduce everyone's income tax rate 30% over the next 3 years? Let us know what you think about the question and send us your vote on a postcard to The Advocates, Box 1978, Boston 02134. And if you'd like a transcript of tonight's debate or a transcript of any of our previous debates, please mail a check or money order for $2 to that same address, The Advocates, Box 1978, Boston 02134. 2 weeks ago, The Advocates debated the question, should the Equal Rights Amendment be ratified? The response to this question, the largest vote we've had since January, was 5,464 for ratification, 8,877 against. The total vote, 14,341, reflected an organized vote of more than 50% on each side of the issue. Tonight's debate is the last debate I'll be moderating this season. During the next program, I'll be out of the country, and the gavel and my other pleasant duties will be in the capable hands of Congressman Michael Harrington of Massachusetts. That debate will be the final debate of the season, the program that was originally scheduled for last June 20th.
Well, if we give it to them.
Yeah, but I'm saying we may give them one ride, food, worldwide. Now, there might be a kind of a concept here that nobody goes hungry. Whatever else you do, we won't necessarily dress you, we won't necessarily clothe you, we won't necessarily house you, but we'll see that you're fed. That can be done. In other words, you don't make it a question of who pays for it. It's very cheap, by the way, in the future to do so. I mean, why not do it? Now, you want to do it in a way which doesn't destroy the native agriculture, because the problem you have, the last thing you want is huge millions and millions of people living off a dole for the United States. And I'm not sure that can be done. But if you don't have that social problem, I think that problem gets solved. The problem of just keeping alive, if you will. I think the real problem in the future, in the advanced country, is the problem of meaning and purpose. In other words, what is it that you're willing to defend? What is it that puts structure in your life? What is it that gives you a sense of, my God, it's good to be alive?
Is this religion we're talking about?
Religion is the easiest way to do it, right, if you can do it that way. But I'm not a prophet. And I don't, we're the only people who have for a while claimed to have Moses, Jesus Christ, and Buddha on the contract. But we looked at their product and changed their mind. I don't know what fills that gap when the need to earn a living erodes in the richest part of the world. You see, now remember, we're only talking about roughly a third of the world at the end of the century at this point, which has these kind of problems. You still have like 30-35% of the world, which is like $300 per capita at the end of the century. You know what I mean?
Think life has meaning.
They know life has meaning. They have no problems with this thing. This is the rich man's problem, not a poor man's problem. This is the failure of success. They got to succeed first to fail. You see. And actually, the most interesting part of the world at this point might be if this kind of 40%, which is moving upward very rapidly, very successful, very high morale, but lots of problems. Now, there are two kinds of problems. There's a Brazil problem, where Northeast Brazil probably is just as poor in the year 2000 as it is today, while Central Brazil is really quite well off. You know, this is the problem of Mexico. 70% of Mexico now are moving up quite well. 30% just stands there, you see. And I don't know what happens in those countries. The Italian example may or may not be a good example of it. You know, where basically the south of Italy ran the government and the north of Italy produced the goods. The biggest single problem will hopefully be a kind of a moral concept that you must not use nuclear weapons or any weapons of this type. The kind of concept which I'm told the Turks have, where they do not poison wells, or they know how to poison wells. That is, if your enemy rapes your wife, kills your daughter, tortures your son, sells your father in slavery, you don't poison his well. Unless he poisons your well. Weapons are okay for retaliation. Eye for the eye, tooth for tooth. It's not a bad rule. Almost every primitive tribe has developed a rule of that sort in the absence of law courts. You know, the only purpose of nuclear devices and such things is to force the other guy to refrain from the use.
From using
them. No other purpose. This is why I get upset when the United States says, the use of nuclear weapons in South Korea is not to be ruled out.
Yeah.
See, we're saving money with the use of weapons, and it's a crazy way to save money. Same thing that would save money with a stockpile. Money isn't very much money. It's a lot, but it's not a great deal. You know what I mean? You know, in other words, I don't think you get this kind of global responsibility that Mark was talking about that soon. You know, I do think eventually you can develop a kind of religious concept of protection of the environment, but I think it's like 50 years away, not 20.
But how many don't estimate enough, I think, that the great speed of change now is so much greater than it was before.
But it's hard because, for one thing, you still got roughly a third of the world at $300 per capita. And they ain't going to join that.
Yeah, but they're going to have satellites over their heads. And they're going to know about the solar world.
They'll know about the solar world, but their major interest will be in, you know, how do I feed myself, how to get my son educated.
But the simple system of an industrial society makes you poor and feel denigrated and contributes to the revolution of rising expectations. A different symbol system, poverty can have the meaning it would have for a Gandhi or St. Francis of Assisi, so that if the industrial mentality continues, and I would predict that it's on its way out, and that what you're describing is in a sense the glorious sunset of the industrial mentality, that I think a whole new symbol system is coming in. Contrary to, say, Herman's multifold trend, when I look at the world and see an astronaut like Russell Schweikert sitting in space and floating in the space suit, looking at the Earth and identifying only with Cape Kennedy and then identifying with Houston and then identifying with the hemisphere and then the next turn identifying with everything and seeing it as the whole Earth and realizing that there are no lines and no boundaries. And he's gone through this conversion experience that's as profound as the one that knocked Paul off his horse and, you know, started the general movement of Christianity. I see that as happening to astronauts or college students, and that for me, as a cultural historian, the transmission of the Buddha Dharma to the West, and I would agree with Toynbee on this, is a profound cultural transformation of the West, and that the way technology is going to be humanized is not through the managerial sciences of the West, but through the mysticism of the East. What you're going to see, I think, is the planetary culture in which the ideological parents are Western materialism that tends to be world-destroying, and Eastern mysticism that tends to be world-denying, and the two of them coming together creating a kind of Pythagorean synthesis that is both technological and mystical. And here I would say that John and Nancy Todd's work in New Alchemy, where they don't use fossil fuel fertilizers but have miniaturized computers in their kind of symbiotic structure that produces energy rather than consumes it, are really the prophets, the scientific prophets of the New Age. So I see four basic trends going on in the world. One is the planetization of nations that was identified by Teilhard de Chardin in 1945. The second is the decentralization of cities. I agree with Margaret Mead that the impact of our technology is to make the industrial city no longer really necessary, and the direction of Tehran and Melbourne and Sydney is just imitating Los Angeles, and it's a mistake, and it will be corrected in the next 30 years. The other is the interiorization of consciousness. Since the Renaissance, we've been expanding and expanding and expanding and expanding, and there's always new worlds to conquer and the new frontier. When we destroyed the Dust Bowl, we moved to California. Well, now California's a mess. We've moved to Australia. When we've destroyed Australia, we'll move to space colonies in outer space. That frontier mentality is in its kind of death throes. The generation is still thinking that way, but I think there's a new consciousness coming that is not just creative expansion in the world, but concentric reconsolidation of a new world image. In that sense, in the turn of the spiral, it's like going back to the Middle Ages, but on a higher level. It's a concentric worldview, what I was talking about, yours as being Hamish. And yours is Hamish and mine's a sort of neo-Catholic sort of worldview. But I think it's going to have radical directions in unpredictability in art and religion and the imagination, and that we're in for a lot of surprises, and that the very structure and tissue of reality isn't going to be the same in the year 2000. And that these predictions that we make about problem solving are the inheritance of the industrial mentality of technocrats and problem solvers. The culture doesn't work that way. I mean, you start out with Muhammad and a vision in a cave, and you get Islamic civilization. You start out with Jesus, and you get the Principia Mathematica and the Sistine Chapel and the B Minor Mass. And the we just have to think about culture in a much richer, more complicated way. But I think the way we're going to have the religious mentality reinforced is that we're in for a lot of very serious challenges, and that these are going to be shocking and disorienting, and the old maps we used to have that told us who we are, where we come from, where we're going, are going to fail. And as these happen, a lot of the crazy kind of religions that you identify in your books, taking the scholarship of Norman Cohn as your source, I think are true, but you know, when there's an artistic period of romanticism, you have psychotic romanticism, but you also have Goethe and Wordsworth and Shelley and you know, Keats and a lot of good things, too.
Years, time period, 100 to 200 years, I wouldn't argue with you.
And I think it's going to go
faster
than 20
years, I
agree with Henry Adams.
Absolutely crazy.
The acceleration of history, I agree with Henry Adams' point that things are faster now.
Yeah, I agree with that point, too. Not that fast.
On that note of partial agreement, Dr. Kahn, Dr. Lee, Dr. Thompson, thank you.